You're listening to Around Comics, episode 183, Emerald City Comic-Con Special, Part 2. Folks, back at the Emerald City Comic Con
Day 2.
That was really stupid.
Jinx.
we didn't even plan that. That was just dumb on accident.
That's just how in tune we are right now.
Yes. Locked into the world of comic book podcasting.
I know. And it's the calm before the storm on Sunday. It's also Mother's Day, so happy Mother's Day. Have you called your wife?
Not yet. No, I let her sleep.
There you go. That's probably the best present you could give
her.
Yeah.
Hopefully she was able to sleep in a little this morning.
Mm-hmm. And it's quiet on the floor. I'm Christopher Niesman, by the way. I'm joined by my partner in crime, Mr. Salazar.
Hello. Yeah,
back to the world of podcasting.
Yes, they dragged me back, tried to get out, and they pulled me back in.
Is it like riding a bike?
An old rusty bike? Quite honestly, yesterday, because I hadn't spoken into a microphone, I hadn't really talked about comics in a long time. The first half hour or so, I was a little rusty. I had to kind of
break out the
get
WD-40.
Back into the shtick and yeah, I had to get back into things and but once I got back into it, felt pretty comfortable. So
yeah, good to have you back and having fun here in the old Emerald City. It's been a good weekend. I crashed early last night though. I ran too hard on Friday.
You burnt down quick last night. It was pretty early evening for you and me and Tom went out and hung out with Scotty and Kari Andrews and Chris Moreno and
the usual cast of characters.
Just kind of wasn't anything crazy actually. We were kind of just chill and had a few drinks and bullshitted with each other.
Everything that you do the night of a big con, except for me. I think I was in bed by 9.
That's pretty early, man.
I had to go home.
Well, that's 11 our time.
Yeah, watch Little People's Court. And,
well, you had dinner at 4.
Yeah,
and
meatloaf.
Yeah, you had your meatloaf at 4. So it was right on schedule.
Mm-hmm. So impressions on the show after a full day of it.
This is a really nice small show. Yesterday I was amazed at the amount of people. And we were talking about a lot, talking with Scotty and Kari and different creators that this was their first time at the show. People were really busy. Artists were really busy doing sketches. I think Scotty sold out of his sketchbooks yesterday in one day. Guys were just really, really busy. And I think we kind of figured it out was that, this is a smaller size show. It's not a huge mega event like New York or San Diego.
And it is totally a comic book show.
Yes, this is completely a comic book show. There's very little anything else. I mean, you have a couple of the celebrity signings and that kind of thing. But I think the big difference is the lack of presence by both Marvel and DC. Mm-hmm. Neither of them have a booth here.
Plenty of writers, artists, and
there's no booth. There's mm-hmm. no, and B is you don't have the sort of swell of journalism or bloggers and websites and media that goes to those other conventions. So this is way more of a fan show.
Oh, yeah.
I mean you there's some big name creators here, and all you have to do to sit down and talk to them for a little while is stand in line, and it's very personable with all these guys, and it's very much a fan friendly show opposed to the big hoopla that surrounds the other. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Those are events. And
yeah,
it actually is kind of nice to go to a show that doesn't have a ton of the big booths with the booming music and screaming people, throwing t-shirts to people that don't obviously have any t-shirts at home because they're killing each other to get to them. It's
way more about the artists and the writers and the fans wanting to get their work and say hello and get their autograph or get their sketches, that kind of stuff. Even the vendors, there's not a whole lot of vendors here. they're enough, but
sure.
It's not like, I mean, this is mostly a creator show.
One of the things that we were talking about last night, which is a little different from other shows I've gone to, it's like you go over into Artist Alley and Gail Simone is set up at a table. And you don't see that at a lot of
right.
shows. Greg Rucka has a table. Brubaker is
Brubaker
set up.
Brubaker sitting there at a yeah. table. And you don't see that because they're usually just doing signings at
the Marvel booth,
booth
the Marvel or the DC booth.
Booth. Yeah, and you have, you know, so yeah, it's really cool that, you know, just bumping into a guy, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, just running into somebody on the floor, running. It's just a more laid back atmosphere. Mm-hmm. The creators aren't in sort of the promotion
yeah.
mode. They're more just laid back and having a good time and enjoying themselves and friendly. And overall, man, I've really, really enjoyed myself in Seattle first and foremost.
Yes.
Seattle's an awesome town.
This is a world-class city, and we may have mentioned it yesterday. Everybody knows how much we love Chicago and love our town, and,
mm-hmm.
and it is a great city. But Seattle may be my favorite destination now.
I'm definitely going to come back to Seattle. I just had so much fun. The people are cool. It's clean.
Oh, yeah.
It's a very walkable city. There's mm-hmm. plenty to do, plenty to see.
It's a good comics town.
Good comic. I mean, it's a cool. This is just a cool, mm-hmm. cool city, and the show is a perfect reason to come, you know, to Seattle, enjoy the city, and then go to the con. And the con's been great. I mean, packed, but not to the point where it's like obnoxious. And
New York,
lots of costumes.
New York,
and lots of, you know,
as great as that show is, it is it's exhausting.
Yeah.
And I've heard the same thing about San Diego. This has been interesting enough that I haven't been bored for one second. I haven't had
right.
a bad experience in Seattle or at the convention. So yeah, it's we're kind of bordering on gushing here, but it's because it has been such a great
weekend. Yeah, it's been a lot of fun, and you know, it's cool. It's not a huge show where it's like you can walk the show in 40 minutes, no
mm-hmm.
problem. See everything. But what's nice about that is it gives you time to linger and see things and go and, you know, and spend more time with creators or spend more time getting sketches or spend more time at a booth, look at, you know. And the other thing I will say about this show that was sort of remarkable was the amount of younger people.
Yes.
Kids, teenagers. This is a much younger show than I'm used to. I mean, we were definitely the old men.
we're the old farts.
Yeah, I mean, there weren't. Most of the people that I saw yesterday were probably in their 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of teenagers and a lot of kids.
Genuinely enthusiastic
yeah.
about comics, too.
Tom had to elbow a six-year-old yesterday in a long box, you know, to get a copy of, like, Action.
Yeah, but that six-year-old stomped on his foot
well,
first.
Well, yeah,
you know, it's
but still, you don't really take your elbow to where I... No, he... But just they actually have a kids' booth here
mm-hmm.
for kids' activities to keep them, you know, having fun and entertained. And, you just see a lot of parents with their kids and a lot of teenagers. And, yeah, it's been a really cool show.
Mm-hmm.
It really has.
Yeah.
I will definitely be wanting to come back to this show and to Seattle.
And we're obviously good luck for the White Sox.
Yeah, 2-0, baby.
Yeah.
2-0. Sorry, Mariners fans.
So the White Sox never play well on the West Coast. It's just because we haven't gone with them.
I guess so, man. And there was a lot of White Sox fans at the game with us Friday
White
night.
White Sox travel well.
Yeah.
Travel
yeah.
well.
It
so
was, it was good.
Well, today's yesterday, a lot of those creators that we were talking about bumping into were very busy at their tables
mm-hmm.
and doing a lot of sketches and signings and all that. So hopefully today we can lure a few over and have some nice sit-downs. So
yeah.
There should be a lot more interviews and
I think my
with
plan
those folks
is
today.
I'm going to ask every creator that we want to talk to for a sketch, pay them
and just have them do it here.
And then just come over here. Yeah, I have to do it at my table.
Hey, that could work.
That might work, and I can
mm-hmm.
get a sketch out of it. So
yeah.
That's the plan. Hopefully, we'll get some good people to talk to and have some more fun on our getaway day today.
Absolutely. So lots of fun stuff coming up on the Emerald City Comic Con special day 2, and then it's back home to the Flatlands.
Yeah, I won't have to walk up hills. That's the only thing about this city.
I'd need a scooter by a Segway.
A Segway, yeah.
Yeah,
it would fit in. A Segway certainly would fit in.
Yes,
yeah,
very, very Seattle in scope. So, yeah, that's my only complaint, man. It's hills here.
It's hill. It's fine going one direction. Coming
back,
kind
of the nature
tough.
Of a hill.
Yeah, well, you know, back in my day, I used to walk to school in the snow uphill both ways,
yeah.
and Yeah. Oh, I want to give a shout out to the fine establishment Vons. If you're in Seattle, over on 6th and Pine, I think it is. There's a cool little bar that we spent the last two nights at called Vons that has
anything you want.
625 different types of alcohol, and I don't know how many hundreds of beers. And compared to Chicago, cheap as hell.
Yeah.
So check out Vons if you're in Seattle.
Yep. Good little.
But
good
where's
little
the bell? Oh, Tom's got the bell.
Oh, Tom's
got.
Okay.
Son of a bitch.
I'll drop it
Ding.
In later.
Ding.
All Vons. Right. All right. We'll be back in just a minute.
All right, and we're back, and we're joined by Mr. Dan DiDio, DC Comics.
Hey there, guys. How are you?
Good.
Very good.
How are you? How's the con going?
Good, actually. It's been a lot of fun. It's the first time I've ever been to Emerald Con. So,
oh, really?
Yeah, first time out here, actually, and it was a lot of fun. Great crowds. We did a couple of panels, and we had a great reaction to what we were doing, and people seemed to be interested in what's coming up and the Final Crisis and everything else going on. So,
something's coming up?
You can't believe it or not, we got to put some books out. Every month they tell me we got to get a certain number of books out.
You get a letter saying where the books for next month. Like,
exactly.
Oh,
again.
Yeah.
What about they go, you want pictures on the pages too? What are you thinking?
How does that work?
Okay. So, we got a couple of things coming out that seem to be getting people excited, so...
I'm excited.
I can tell. You can see you're having a hard time keeping yourself in the seat.
This is really exciting.
Oh, okay. Yeah, this is... Wow.
Obviously a real long day for you, then.
this is me being very excited.
Okay.
You must enjoy going to cons, because you seem to go to an awful lot of cons.
I actually do. I say this a lot, and it always gets misinterpreted, but I keep on saying it because I don't care.
Saying it the same way over and over.
Exactly. Sooner or later, somebody will understand what the hell I'm saying. It gives us the opportunity. I always love the fact that the fans come out. They make the effort to come to the shows. You know, they're paying money to come in. They come to see the panels. And they're extremely passionate about the characters, about the books, about what's going on. And I love that feedback. I love that interaction. Because, you know, sometimes you're working and you're working just in this little glass bubble.
Solitary.
We're making decisions that really affect so many of the characters and affect so many people, the way this story's unfold and such, that you want to make sure you're in touch with the fans, you're in touch with everybody, and more importantly, that you listen. You can't do everything that everybody wants, naturally, but if what you can do is hear what they're saying and understand, distill down what the core concerns are, so therefore you can address them some way in the stories, you know, over the course of the issues.
That'd be a hell of a month if you did.
Here we go.
We pleased everyone. There's no one upset.
It's all fan based.
We're just pulling people off.
Just pull people
off.
Yeah, anybody walks by.
It's the end of the show, man. The people running out of people. I gotta tell you, I'm at the bottom of the list.
I always thought of like comic fandom as sort of for the publishers and for artists and creators as sort of both a gift and a curse in some ways, because it's the same things that, you know, it's like the people that are so passionate and dedicated, and obviously that's a gift. I mean, that's a great thing as a publisher to have, but on the same time, it's that passion and dedication that can, you know, kind of get...
Say our fans are extremely loyal and extremely fickle simultaneously. They're loyal to the characters, loyal to a fall to the medium. They love and care about comics, but they're really fickle about what they want to see and what excites them most.
Right.
And the reality is that we have a fan base, you know, because we do panels, we talk to people, and we know it's just the facts alone that we have a very strong fan base that's been reading comics for a very long period of time. Mm-hmm. Whether they've been reading continuously for 10, 20, 30 years or went away and came back, they're extremely knowledgeable, not just about the characters, but about the creators. So the days of just putting a comic out and people grabbing it sight unseen because, oh, that's my favorite Superman, that's my favorite Batman, now they're much more in tune with how the characters and the stories are created.
Right.
So they're more vested in what goes on there.
Well, it's a more educated consumer base.
Absolutely.
You know, when I was a kid, like I had no idea
who anyone was. Yeah, sure.
I was like, oh, it's the Flash. All right, all right.
I always joke. I said, I remember the days, you know, where you had to be on the shelf. You know, if a newsstand, you had to be on the shelf. So it didn't matter whether it was an original or a reprint. Something had to be out.
Right.
And I always go back to there was a Ghost Rider comic that came out where it covers Ghost Rider versus the Hulk. And I pick it up, and it's a reprint of the first issue. And I'm like, where the hell's the Hulk?
Where's the Hulk?
And sure enough, but then the next issue, almost the same color, Ghost Rider versus the Hulk again.
respect.
And there, at least the Hulk was in that issue, but it shows you that they had to get something out the door.
Right.
And we can't do that now because there's a certain conceit or an expectation for the books that we put out. It's people aren't just grabbing it because they want to fill the collection, but they really are interested in what's happening inside the book and who created it.
Yeah. And with the, you know, with the comics, of course, probably more expensive than they were back, at least when I started, you know, buying when I was a kid. And if the more educated consumer, you know, people especially want what they feel is a $3 worth of what they get.
It's still an inexpensive entertaining medium when you look at other things, but these are people's hard-earned money, so you can't take it for granted.
Exactly.
You know, and that's the one thing that you never want to say, oh, you know what, it's only $3. It's never only $3 to anybody. You know, if, you know, I remember the days when comics went from 20 cents to 25, and there I was as a kid cutting my list, one book out of every five had to go in order to keep the same spend the same amount of money. And
now, you know, we just have to find out how we can hide that from our wives.
Yeah, pretty much.
Pretty much.
Yeah. It's an investment, honey. Really, you don't really want to go on vacation.
That giant Spectre statue.
What? I want it.
It's his art. Soul art.
The business of promoting comics has changed a lot. Like, you know, everything changes. You have the internet and just the explosion in conventions. And, you know, this is my third convention this year, and I'm really tired. And
since you're old.
I actually look at it the other way. Actually, the conventions reinvigorate me.
Really?
Yeah. When you're working as hard as you are trying to get stuff out, like I said, we're working in a bubble, so it exhausts you. But when you see how it affects people and they get energized, you feed off the energy of the room. I love our panels because we get everybody all worked up. And it's, you're literally feeding off that energy because you see people caring that much and getting that excited. You know you're on the right track. You can't rush. You want to rush back and just get back into work again and say, okay, I think we got something. Let's go. Let's push it. Let's go farther. Let's try this. Let's try that. And a lot of the energy goes on. Ian Sattler's, who's hanging over my shoulder over here. You know,
I'm
Ian.
Way off your shoulder.
The imagery is him hanging
right there. Yeah, I know. Nobody can see that. I'm like, oh, hey, man. I'm texting somebody else over here.
Really creepy, dude.
I feel the cold hand of death.
Close to me. It's
okay, now you're cramping my space.
You're in the bubble. You're in my bubble.
Take a step back.
My personal
I
zone.
I had to respect the
dignity
of 5-foot halo.
You can't get close.
All time.
Everybody else calls it a fallout zone.
Yeah, right.
Get out of arm's reach.
Exactly.
Well, how much does your day-to-day job change from con season to not con season? I mean, it's so much travel involved. And
it doesn't, because the cons are on the weekends.
they don't have comp time, do they?
You know, not really. So, you know, I mean, realistically, you know, we were working away on Thursday, flew out Friday morning. I'll be back in the office on Tuesday, flying back on Monday, and back into the grind.
Wow.
The book's got to come out, bottom line. And it's a monthly business. We put out books on a weekly basis. We got to be there. You got to sign them off. You got to see what happens. And if you're gone too long, I mean, that's primary what Ian's job is, that he's keeping track of everything, you know, in every incarnation of every script going out there, from script to the first scenes of the art to the finished art, the colors, and making sure that it's all still making sense. Because things can move so quickly and go off track, you know, and we're working so far in advance that if you do go off a track, it doesn't get fixed within 15 minutes. It gets fixed in 3 months, 4 months, because that's the process.
Have you guys been able to learn from like 52 and now Countdown on the weekly books? You know, is it getting any easier to do that stuff? Or?
No, the fun part about doing three different versions of a weekly book is that you make new sets of problems for yourself on each incarnation.
All new mistakes.
It's all new mistakes. And what you do is you fix something that's broken here, and you break something else over there. And that's what happened. I mean, what happened was that in 52, we had four writers who were supposed to write. Each one was supposed to do an individual issue.
Right.
That's the way it was working. But they all got together, and they said, well, we had a great idea. We're all going to write every issue together. It's okay. Sounds great on paper.
There's a crack of thunder.
Yeah.
Ominous music.
And the idea is like, oh, well, we each do just 5 pages, so how much can that take? Well, the problem is that you do a meeting for the outline, for the story, every week. So that eats up your time. Then you try to condense what you would want to put in the book for the amount of pages you have available to you. That takes a lot more time. So what happens is that the writers, for four writers for 52, who thought they were only doing 5 pages a week or 20 pages a month, were doing the work of 4 series. And it impacted everything else. And it really, they were exhausted. And you could talk to a couple of them.
Greg was just here.
Yeah.
He said they're like old war buddies now.
Yeah, it was. They went through the war together. But more importantly, some of the guys were like, I don't know if I ever want to write a comic again after that experience. Yeah. So we go, okay, let's change the process. So we changed the process, and now what we do is we put a head writer up there. We're working with four writers. What happens then, though, we try to go wide and tie in all the stories to everything. But when you try to tie everything together, not every series moves at its own pace. Right. So all of a sudden you're faced with, okay, we're going to take Kyle Rayner and bring him into our story over here, into Countdown. Well, but he's still busy.
Yeah.
In the middle of in the middle of Sinestro Corps War. Do you want to sacrifice Sinestro Corps War to make Countdown story work faster? Well, wait a minute. Flash is dead in Flashbook, but that book has to come out this month. Well, we needed more time to set that up. We don't have it now. Okay, so that gets hurt. So a lot of storytelling was compromised because you were trying to line up all the stories up properly.
Yeah, stuff that wasn't really, I would say, that important to enjoying like the whole story.
Yeah.
When you're getting hung up on making
exactly.
sure...
Exactly.
A lot of your job is making sure all of those individual pieces fit together.
And actually, that's what Ian's job is now, because he's looking 6 months out. He's looking 8 months out.
Look at him.
He's running away.
he's crying. And just
why did
down.
You tell people that?
But the idea is that now, what happened with Countdown is that because we were worried about this book over here, somebody's doing on Green Lantern on the right, somebody's doing Flash on the left, somebody's doing JLA in another corner, all of a sudden it's like, well, who's taking ownership for the story beats?
Right.
Who's covering what major events?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So what happens is that you soften the impact of the overall storytelling because you diffused who is telling the key emotional beat of the story. Is it a Flash beat or is it a Countdown beat? Is it a Green Lantern beat or a Countdown beat? So what happens is that you became six of one, half dozen the other, and nobody took charge.
Where's your center spine?
Exactly. Yeah. And therefore, it weakened the overall storytelling. And then when we realized that, we said, okay, stop. We got to break everything loose and fix it. But like I said, it takes four months to get there.
Tom made that point last week. He said whenever you're doing a weekly book, it's like, you can't stop.
You can't stop. But even more importantly, if it takes you 3 months to fix it, you know, that's 18 issues in weekly comics, you know, which is a huge chunk of change. And that's a huge investment on the fans' part. So now what we've done, we've created a new set of problems. We got one team writing the whole thing, and basically Trinity is on the shoulders of Kurt Busiek and Mark Badley. So you live and die, and your success and failure is all built on that team. And we have an immense respect and faith in them, but it's all on their shoulders.
Well,
it's a lot of responsibility.
You can always just force Mike Norton to do it.
What?
that's
one great thing about it. The backup artist, and you know, I hate using the word backup artist because it's not true. It's really it's a supplemental story that supports the front story, which is really great. You have Mike Norton, you have Scott McDaniel, you have Tom Derenick. These are all guys who are just hardworking, you know, delivery
lunchbox guys.
Yeah. They know how to meet a deadline.
Yeah.
And that's why we know we have a lot of faith. Being able to deliver product. And Bagley, you know, God bless him, he's 11 issues in already. And you know what? he's a machine. And he's the type of guy, you talk about me with conventions, he basically came to us and goes, I don't want to do any conventions, I got to hit my schedule. And we're like, oh, God bless you.
Fall to your knees.
Busiek has shown over his career that he can do these long stories that have these great moments in them and in these great vignettes.
He understands the universe. He knows it intimately. He knows the characters. He knows how to tell it from a street level, a cosmic level. He knows how to integrate it all. And that's one of the reasons why we have incredible faith in what he's been able to create for us.
Do you see the weekly book as being like a DC, like a thing that, as long as it's...
Well, I already know what the fourth weekly would be.
Yeah.
And it's a complete reinvention of the wheel for the fourth time.
Yeah.
And we're hoping that the anticipated success, because I actually believe it will be a huge success for us with Trinity, will justify the creation of another weekly.
I like them. I like getting
We have a distribution system that is a weekly distribution system. So therefore, we should create to the speed in which we deliver product. You know, everything that we do, all the media is built on the delivery system, how fast somebody can put something out there. Yeah. So realistically, we should move to the quickest we can move, which is a weekly delivery.
Well, considering other medium, other entertainment outlets are getting faster and faster, on-demand entertainment is becoming that kind
and that's
of
it. And that's the whole thing is that you sit back too long, you miss the boat.
Yeah.
And I think what our strength is the periodical nature of the business we've created, so therefore we should play to our strengths. And the periodical and the weekly periodical is one of the strengths of the comic business.
Well, we record out of a comic shop normally whenever we're not jet setting around the country, and Mark
jet setting.
Mark
they told me it was a prop plane.
Yeah, doing your private plane.
It's a nice Greyhound.
Our shop owner Mark Beatty loved 52. It helped his business so much. And one of the things that he said is that, first of all, it was like having a top-selling book every week.
Yep.
And it also brought people that would maybe come into the shop every other week or once a month. They were now coming into the shop every week.
Right.
And they weren't just picking up 52 or Countdown. It also gets them to pick up the other two things that they're interested in. So the retailers, it was a huge boom for them.
As I said, you know, because I bought comics until I walked, you know, until the moment I started at DC, and I still go to the comic shop every week. You know, we still, like, Ian and I on the way, you know, at the end of the, you know, every Wednesday, still going to the comic store. I like it. It's a habit of mine. I like doing it. And more importantly, though, we went to two comic stores over here on Friday, but what I was saying is that you want a reason to go to the store, and if you know something's going to be there every week, it gives you justification for going.
Right.
And that's what we're trying to do, is justify people's reason for making the trip. Because people go, hey, you know what, I don't have to go today. Oh, it's Superman's not coming out.
Yeah.
I can get later, I can do this. Because, nope, this one's coming out this week. You know what, they're delivering it on Wednesday. I got to be there on Wednesday to get it.
The next week of 52, that's why you have to go to the shop.
That's funny. Yeah. She knows not to call me on Wednesday after work.
Exactly. But I mean, that was the fun of it and the difficulty. And it was tough, honestly. It was real tough for me after DCU Zero to skip and to take a month off.
Oh, yeah.
You're
sitting there,
it was like,
shaking.
You know, and I'm like, you know, when we had long discussions about this and whether or not we should just go straight into Trinity. But you know what? With DCU Zero, that was 104 weeks in a row delivered consistently between 52 Countdown and Zero. And what we thought, though, is that we didn't want to confuse issues. Final Crisis is its own entity.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to introduce Trinity in the middle of the window of Final Crisis, lest people get confused with what Trinity is compared to Final Crisis.
Yeah, did I have to read all of Countdown?
Exactly.
To
And everybody seemed like it was good. I think the funny part is that we took only a month off, and we argued, should we take 2 months off, 3 months off, a week, 2 weeks? We chose 1 month. And it seemed that everybody reacted very positively.
A little breather, a little...
Catch my breath, but I don't want to be out of that business for too long.
Sure.
And they're
shaking.
Actually looking forward to it.
We're going to put a week. We're gonna, let's
but it is, but, you, but you, we've, you've built that habitual purchase, and you don't want to lose those people. Because, like I said, there's so many other things out there that we're fighting for their attention for, you know?
Absolutely.
You know, luckily we took the week off that Grand Theft Auto came out. You know?
I made my life.
Wait a minute, that's probably why you guys took it off, because it was coming out. That's it. I know. All the creators, all the artists.
You took the damn week off.
Why are we not getting pages
in? Let's get the hell out of the way.
Check the Xbox gamer tag.
Exactly.
Well, one last thing before we let you go. While we have you here, Tom wants to know if you can get Jeff Johns to write every DC book.
Cause you mean he's not?
almost.
What the hell goes on here? What book did he leave?
You know something I don't know.
Oh, sorry.
Don't tell me he took a day off. He doesn't always play Grand Theft Auto.
I don't see him playing GTA.
I don't know.
I don't even know. I have never
Grand
played.
He is, I thought so. Okay.
I'm trying to admit to who I know might be playing.
Nice.
Well, Dan, thanks so much for coming
by.
I really, really enjoyed
your pleasure. Thanks a lot, guys.
Have a good show.
Thanks.
Good luck with the rest of the show.
Thanks.
All right, we're back, and I am joined by two lovely ladies from the Suicide Girls. How are you guys doing today?
Doing good. Lixon Suicide here.
Valencia Suicide here.
Nice to meet you both. You have a booth set up at the show today. What are you guys promoting? What is the Suicide Girls? Tell me about the Suicide... Not that I don't know. Tell our listeners. Yes, for those who don't.
We are an alternative pinup website. A bunch of hot, tattooed and pierced girls, some with crazy colored hair. We're all naked on the internet.
Wow, who doesn't like that?
It's also an awesome just online community, kind of like MySpace, but with a lot less errors.
A lot less lame people.
People actually spell and use complete sentences.
And we've branched out to, there's a burlesque troupe. We've got a DVD over at the booth, actually, documenting the first tour. We've been on episodes of CSI. We've got, and we're all over the G4 network all the time. We're on HBO and Showtime.
It's huge. Suicide Girls are everywhere.
We're having a TV show of our own soon.
Really?
Well,
I saw the, was it HBO? there was like a sort of documentary made on the traveling.
That was probably the burlesque tour.
Yeah, that's what it was. And, you know, the interesting thing about what you guys do is that it was sort of like the anti bunny thing. You know what I mean? It was like you don't have to be, 5'11 and 34 to be sexy.
Exactly.
I think that's awesome because, you know, a guy who is always liked tattoos and colored hair. And I mean, it's like not everybody
hot
looks
girls
the same.
One
yeah,
size.
You know, yeah, exactly, absolutely. You know, and I think
they're not all blonde with blue eyes.
And I think it's really a positive thing too because so many more people can, you know, young girls out there can see that kind of thing and go, yeah, I don't have to be this certain thing. Mm-hmm. To be powerful and sexy and strong and, you know, and smart and everything else.
We have lots of girls who come up and say the exact thing. You guys are such an inspiration. I'm just really glad there are models out there that don't look like, quote-unquote, model.
Right,
models.
Right.
So.
Yeah, because who can look? I mean, it's like who lives up to a photograph anyway, mm-hmm. airbrushed, you know. So you guys do a lot of the cons? Is this, I mean, a pretty normal thing?
We've done
of
a few. The website as a whole, we've got close to like 2,000 girls or so. So whenever there's a convention in one area, some of the local girls will come out. We're up in Seattle from Portland.
Oh, okay.
Actually, us two.
Well, so there's about 10 of you over there, I think.
Something like that.
A little bit less than that today.
We had 15 or so yesterday. I think we've got 5, 6 something over there today. Maybe 7 at some point. We're coming and going on lunch breaks and wandering around and whatnot.
And the website's transformed from, you know, the initial concept of it. I mean, there's a lot of content provided by other people. And I know comic book related, Warren Ellis has a column over there that he does, and there's just a lot more of information and stuff on there. And that's
Will
another.
Will Wheaton is our geek editor. There's a section of the website with different news stories and whatnot. So you can read it for the articles.
Read it for the articles, absolutely. Well, cool. Thank you both for joining me. It's awesome. I think, like I said, I think what you guys do is really cool. And
our pleasure.
And thanks a lot for coming on Around Comics.
Absolutely.
We're on the floor at the Emerald City Comic Con with one of our past favorite interviewees. We're joined by Richard Starkings from Comicraft and Elephant Men fame. Richard, how you doing?
Hey, Chris. Do I speak into this mosquito net here? Is that what I'm doing?
Trying to keep away the flies.
Right. Well, we heard about Seattle, all the water that, you know, we came out with bug repellent and ready to go. You get us flatlanders out here. And we have
I was hoping for a little bit more rain. I'm English. I thought I'd get some wet weather while I was here.
It's been nice. It's been sunny and dry.
Crazy.
How do the English adapt to L.A.?
Well, you know, it's kind of like being in a English tourist resort all year round. So, you know, we kind of like it because it's got, you know, Santa Monica is sort of the typical British town. It's got a pier, it's got a beach, and it's got sunshine all year round. So it's sort of, you'll see a lot of British people congregate in that area.
Nice.
So we like it, but we miss, you know, those of us that live here miss the rain.
So it's like vacationing in Spain, right, on the Spanish
coast.
But
we're in Seattle, and it's not raining. That's my point.
It is a lot. I keep hearing all this rain. It rains every day. It's always raining.
Everybody's depressed.
Has it rained once? Everybody's happy. It's clean. It's
crazy. I haven't seen any depressed people from Seattle. I think the only one I know is my artist Justin Norman, who's not here because he's depressed.
I think they make all this stuff up to keep us away from this city. They don't want
us
all coming here because
it's
a great city.
Best kept secret.
Yeah. I think that's what it is. Oh, it rains all the time. It's cold.
Don't go there.
Don't go here.
Yeah, and the people are really positive, really cheerful. Yeah. This is a great crowd.
Yeah.
The show.
It's been a one heck of a show for a smaller con. I mean, it's been busy both days, and, you know, it's nice because it's more of a fan show as opposed to the big media things. And
well, I was just talking to Jim's brother. What's his name? Is Joe? Jim DeMarcus's brother.
Oh, yes.
And I was pointing out that, you know, all the hospitals and mental institutions are painted green in order to keep everybody sedate. It's called Institution Green, the color. So I'm just wondering if that's contributing to the nice passive atmosphere here, because all the drapes are green, it's Emerald City.
The walls
all
are
the
green.
Walls are green. So I think maybe somebody knew what they were doing.
Yeah, I think you might be onto something.
Yeah, and you're the only booth with the power drop, I think. So there's no boom boxes, no videos.
No, it's awesome to not have.
Nobody's complaining about their neighbors here.
It's been nice because of that. You don't have the huge booths with the lights and
the
wrestlers.
The constant DVD and videos. So, I think Wizard World could learn a thing or two from Emerald City. I wish Jim was running those shows.
Yeah, no kidding. He knows how to take care of everybody, too.
It's really, really friendly atmosphere. All the guys that are helping out are really helping out the people that are here.
Yeah.
And, I've been to a lot of shows. This is my first Seattle show, but that's how you should treat your exhibitors, your guests, and your retailers, because they're the people bringing in the customers.
Bringing in the people, absolutely. Yeah, too many times you hear stories about how creators and exhibitors are treated at shows, and it's like ridiculous. I mean, why bother going?
And if exhibitors are treated well, the exhibitors are going to treat the customers well. And if the customers are treated well, they're going to be more excited about reading comics, and that should be the goal.
Yeah. I mean, that's the whole. I mean, I've heard from more than one creator, today talking about, or not creator, more than one fan talking about how the atmosphere around Artist Alley, it's just everybody's really relaxed and so much more friendly and everything than at the bigger show.
I've always felt that Artist Alley should be the spine, it should be the center of any show, because that's why people want to come. They want to see the people creating the comics.
Yeah.
That's what makes the show unique.
Exactly.
Artist Alley.
Yeah.
Every other show is very similar.
And it's a shame, I know that there's been a lot of conversation amongst the organizers of San Diego Comic Con about really trying to keep Artist Alley, but they haven't worked hard enough to do so.
Yeah.
It really should be a big central area where the artists are given pride of place. It shouldn't be up to the publishers to give artists pride of place. Artists should be, they should be given a free ride at any show. They should be given a table. They should be treated as honored guests, and they should be the focus.
Artists and podcasters.
Well, I think that's not such a fine line. It's more of a sort of baseball field between the two.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Well, you're old hat at conventions.
Old hat. Oh gosh.
Wow.
Is that like an old?
That's a compliment.
Is that like an old shoe?
No, comfortable shoe.
Well, like a comfortable old shoe.
Good pair of broken jeans.
Right.
But your career kind of started at Marvel UK.
Yeah, right? I've been going to Comic Cons. Well, I've been going to shows. My brother used to take me to small marts, which is what we called a comic book market, a comic mart in England. I've been going to them since I was 10 years old.
Wow.
In fact, when I used to go to shows, my brother was a dealer.
So what, 10, 12 years?
Thank you. He only says that because he's also follically challenged. So he used to take me to shows when he was a dealer. He used to deal in Golden Age comics. And other dealers and people in the industry used to say to me, "Are you Mel Starking's brother?" And I used to say, "Yes, I'm Mel Starking's brother." But then about 20 years later, when he was going to the Westminster Mart in London, people used to come up to him and say, "You Richard Starking's brother?"
Nice.
He didn't like that at all.
Nice.
I'm the youngest
turn
of four.
Turn the
tables on. Turn about in fair play, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, obviously, when I have you over here to talk about Elephant Man, it's one of our favorite books. And
thank you.
It just consistently good stories, great art. Whether it's Ladrone working on the Hip Flask or Justin Mortat, for people that read the covers, it is just such a well crafted book. And you just finished up the 3-issue story on War Toys. And
yeah.
It was a great story. Kind of talk about how the genesis of that book came about.
Well, War Toys was really spun out of one illustration that Ladrone did in Unnatural Selection, which was the variant cover of issue one of War Toys. It was a shot of the character Horn with a legion of soldiers behind him, and I never figured that they actually had fought the war until he drew that illustration. I thought, well, yeah, it is kind of odd if we have these characters that are bred to be unstoppable fighting machines.
Right.
If they end up not fighting a war. So I sort of changed my mind when I saw that illustration. And Ladrone has that tendency to throw something at me that I hadn't imagined That he felt was sort of inevitably part of the story.
That's got to be a lot of fun to have you know, the creation take a life of its own. And
It is great to work with it. This is the advantage always of working with a collaborator, mm-hmm. is that they'll throw you something you didn't expect, and you're able to sort of throw it back and put a bit of a spin on it, and then they'll throw it back to you in another way. So in one sense, that illustration, I wanted to write the story of that illustration, and the way he was working back then, every panel was a cover.
Right.
Every panel has so much work in it, because he would blow it up on the screen and really put so much detail. He's not putting quite as much detail in anymore, because things need to be finished, you know. But I really wanted to use that as a cover and write that story. So that's where War Toys started from. But once Justin got a hold of it, he really sort of, went to town. And it actually headed in a direction I didn't expect, because I had asked for two resistance fighters on the last page of issue one. And he made one of them a girl, of course, with a beret.
He does
We've seen his sketchbook.
Yeah. He likes to draw girls. He likes to draw girls. No question about that.
And I like to see him draw girls, so that's fine. But the character in War Toys I hadn't originally imagined as being a girl. I'd imagine it as being a sort of embittered John Connor resistance fighter. But when I saw the girl, I thought, well, I know he's going to draw her well, so let's make it a girl. And that's how Yvette came to be into being. And Yvette completely took over the story. It was not going to be her story, but she personified the sort of small human fighting against these unstoppable fighting machines. So it was one of those serendipitous things that it started as one story with one direction, and just that sort of addition of Justin, you know, putting a little bit more character into a drawing made me turn in a different direction. And I think it was more poignant because it's war is so masculine and Yvette is so feminine, and yet she becomes more and more hardened, and if you might say masculine, and Hip becomes more in touch with his feminine side. You know, so he becomes more human and she becomes more animalistic in the course of the series, which is that was the intent, no matter who the other character was. But I think Justin's got a really human touch, the way he draws both the elephant men and the human characters. So he sort of polarized the humanity and the animality in a way I didn't expect. And it's actually one of the favorite things that he and I have done together. And I really think he broke free of Ladrone's shadow in War Toys, because perhaps it was a sort of separate story. It was set in the past of the elephant men, and it wasn't necessarily using characters that Ladrone had created. He could really bring his own expertise and ability.
And that, I mean, to me, that's one of the cool things about the whole Elephant universe, is that, you know, because it's this, you know, huge story that you know, you have the war and the history of it and all these characters, and you could pull from anywhere in there, and tell any type of story you really want.
The next issue, which is issue 12, we pulled forward a fill-in just to gain some time on the schedule, because we did fall a little bit behind. So issue 12 is a fill-in by Rob Steen, and it tells the story of two characters who are also sort of throwaway characters that Ladrone put in a panel of Unnatural Selection. It's the two guys digging through the mass graves from
Mappo.
the Mappo headquarters. And I always thought there was one guy looking at a skull in the drawing. I was like, I wonder what he's thinking. So that story is about the two cleanup guys, two South African guys, two basically blue-collar workers.
Right.
Working in a mass grave and what kind of effect that has on them. And, you know, I do enjoy the ability to sort of say, well, here's a story that I can tell that's separate from the sort of soap opera elements of the ongoing series. And if anything, I'm spoiled for choice. And I think a lot of people would like me to get back on track and tell the story of Hip Flask, Vanity Case, Mickey, and all those guys. But
we'll wait.
I think what makes it interesting is the bigger tapestry and the bigger texture of the stories, which is something that always appealed to me in books like Judge Dredd or TV shows like The X-Files, that they would have the mythology, but then they would do Monster of the Week stories. And in Judge Dredd, often Judge Dredd was a secondary character in his own strip, and so the writer would sort of create a character. I remember there was one story about a guy who sees Judge Dredd and starts running away. he just feels guilty instantly, and Judge Dredd says, "Stop, citizen," and starts chasing him, and the guy starts pushing people out of the way, knocking over a child, breaking out through a window, and he commits so many crimes running away from Judge Dredd, and gets thrown in jail for like 5 years. And he said, but Judge Dredd, why did you stop me in the first place? He said, well, you dropped a piece of litter and I was going to caution you. So, it's really like the effect that the characters have. Judge Dredd has an effect just by walking into the room, and the Elephant Men have an effect. I was saying to somebody yesterday that if an Elephant Man walked across the hall right now, if a real live creature like that, everybody would have a very interesting reaction.
Sure.
Even if he wasn't behaving in any kind of a monstrous way. And of course, the world of the Elephant Men is one where people have already got over that initial reaction, but still carry certain feelings,
lingering
feelings about them. You know, and we're actually doing a one shot. Marion Churchland, who's a friend of Justin's, she's doing an 8-page Conan story right now for Dark Horse, but she's doing a 22-page issue of Elephant Men just about Mickey. And it's really about Mickey's lingering attraction to Hip Flask, and the whole issue is really about the way she feels and about the way her mother feels about that, and it's really a sort of examination of someone who's attracted to the Elephant Men rather than repulsed by them. So I really do enjoy sort of stopping and exploring that kind of moment rather than just sort of brushing past it and throwing it away.
It amazes me sometimes, with characters that are based on
anthropomorphic.
There you go. It's very hard. A lot of times it's very hard to make them convincing characters. But with other than like Black Sad, which is a book that obviously did it, extremely well, and Elephant does it so well. I mean, there's with Hip, there's times where you, at least I do, forget that he looks the way he does, and he's such a poignant character. He's so humane,
right,
and human, even though he's he is what he is. It just amazes me that character has been able to and
yet he's done so little.
maybe that is it too.
I'm gratified that you pick up on that. I always felt that when and we talked about this last time, when a character like The Thing is written very well, even though you really don't know a lot about Ben Grimm, you really understand his dilemma.
Right.
It has a lot to do with his attraction to Alicia Masters, but it also has so much to do with that dilemma of being a tough guy or a sweetheart.
Right.
And that's Ben Grimm's dilemma, Ben Grimm is a sweetheart. And in fact, I think he was one of the things that comes across very well in the movies. I always thought it would be easier to make a character like Johnny Storm sympathetic, but they did a really good job of making him slick and obnoxious and making Ben Grimm a sweetheart. The one that you would...
Ben's the one that you feel connected to.
You feel connected to, and you would feel like he would protect you and not be only interested in himself. And I think that's what's attractive about Hip Flask, in that he's the sort of everyman character that you're going to project your hopes and dreams onto.
Absolutely.
You're the one that you know that you're connected to him, and you know that the reason that the girls are attracted to him, because really he's us.
Yeah.
Really, the girls are attracted to us. They don't see it inside.
It's the sensitive guys,
Yeah.
the monster on the outside a little bit.
And I think one thing that's been interesting to me as a writer is that I don't know why I've avoided sympathetic human male leads, other than they're already there, you just can't see them. They are the male leads that we already have, are the Elephant Men themselves. But I've been toying with the idea of introducing a male character, but I know that would create conflict, that it would be conflict with the Elephant Men themselves.
Right.
So I've been sort of avoiding doing that consciously, because even though it might be an interesting character angle, I'd rather sort of fully develop the Elephant Men first.
The other thing I think you do so well is that you really balance between, not telling things too on the nose. I mean, you obviously with the Elephant Men, you can draw a lot of things from it. Whether it's politics and religion and racism, and you know, there's so many elements in it, but you do such a fine job of not ever, you know, preaching or pointing, you know, pointing things out on the nose.
Are you saying I just don't have an opinion?
No, I think, well,
you have the respect for the readers to develop. Yeah.
Well, I think though that the way most of us move through the world is we don't have a hard and fast opinion. We react.
Right.
And the way I've unraveled the story of the Elephant Men and the story of the world war in which they fought has been on a need-to-know basis, because that's how we come to understand, for instance, what's going on in Iraq right now. It's not that we aren't interested or concerned. It's that we find out the information when we hear about a specific story like the rescue of the female Marine, mm-hmm. you know, so immediately we become emotionally invested and we start to make a decision about what that means to us mm-hmm. as people that are hearing the news. But that still doesn't mean we know the full story.
Right.
You know, when we hear about Abu Ghraib, we hear what makes us react.
And,
so
yeah.
we see one photograph of a guy hooked up to electrodes with a hood over his head. We have an emotional reaction to it. It's not an intellectual. It's not mm-hmm. a...
Educated
yeah. reaction. It's an emotional one, and both sides depend on our emotional reaction. You know, I was watching Saving Private Ryan last night. There was just I just got the last half hour where there's the bloodbath at the end where mm-hmm. Tom Hanks' character dies a slow death, and Private Ryan wonders what that was all about, because of course he was being extracted from the war, and it was a totally emotional depiction of a conflict between German and American soldiers.
Yeah.
I was reading, just before War Toys, I was reading some books by a very popular author in Europe called Sven Hassel. He was a Danish soldier who fought for the Germans in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And all my school friends used to read Sven Hassel, and I used to be very dismissive of that. I thought, oh, that's just glorifying war, and I won't sully my mind with that material. I'm too busy reading science fiction. But they're really good books because they're written from the point of view of a soldier that's just as much a victim as a British soldier
sure.
or an American soldier. And it's the first book is called Comrades of War, and it really is about how his friends became a unit. And another book I was reading, a sort of a non-fiction book called Acts of War, describes how soldiers in battle cannot relate to the bigger picture politically. They relate to each other, and they're trained to save one another, and it becomes emotional for them. So when they're in a conflict, it's emotional for them to save their buddy, because that's them saving themselves.
Sure.
Because their emotional connections become all about who they're connected to in their unit. So this is why in wartime there's so much focus on single fighting units with continuity of commanders. Continuity
well, because otherwise it's too much for them to grasp.
They're not effective that way.
Right.
So this series of books by Sven Hassel really beautifully illustrates that, and they will come across other soldiers. They'll interact with enemy. They'll be captured. But it's all about the human ordeal of going through the war. In the same way Saving Private Ryan was sort of a revelation, in that it was purely about the horrors faced in that human ordeal,
mm-hmm.
which ultimately led in one person surviving and another dying. And at the end of Saving Private Ryan, Ryan says to his wife, "Tell me I was a good person. Because tell me my life was worth saving."
Yeah.
And I think whether it's the Elephant Men you're talking about, or any soldier, or any human being going to any situation in their life, you know, how are you creating the most value? No matter what you've done, we all make mistakes. And whether we're fighting in a war we believe in or not, and whether we are living in a country we believe in or not, it's always, from this day onward, what do you make of that? What do you know, you can be anti-war, but taking part in a conflict because you're part of the emergency services, or you're part of in some way all of us are connected to the war.
Sure.
But from each day, how do you respond to that? How do you respond? And in fact, we're going to do a second War Toys series where you'll see how Hip behaves in the war as he becomes more human, in fact, you know. And I think, again, reading this book, Acts of War, I realized that every single soldier goes through that experience whereby when you're facing a situation where you're surrounded by civilians and you don't know whether the 14-year-old is your enemy or the 94-year-old old man that's limping is your enemy, then you have to regard everyone as your enemy for that same self-preservation.
Yeah. And it's a dehumanization of your enemy, too.
You dehumanize the enemy, yeah. And you give greater humanity to your colleagues, and you give greater humanity to the country you're serving, because it's essential for your own survival to do so. So what I was exploring in War Toys was how important it was for the resistance to dehumanize the enemy, and that how inevitable it was for the elephant men to become humanized, because they are half human,
right.
And even though you can brainwash soldiers the way the Khmer Rouge were brainwashed, if you've ever seen the movie The Killing Fields, you know, Pol Pot's political regime, Khmer Rouge, I think they were called, which might mean Red Tigers, but basically they trained children to be soldiers and believe that everybody else was the enemy from a very, very young age.
Well, you see that in countries today. I mean, you see that in...
But ultimately, once you develop a relationship with somebody that's your enemy...
that conflict all of a sudden is...
Yeah. There's a great documentary maker in England called Louis Theroux, who makes... he basically sort of wanders into the middle of a situation that he wants to make a documentary about. It can be about celebrities, or it can be about... He was talking about a few weeks ago about hunting in South Africa. There's legitimized hunting where you pay to kill a rhino or pay to kill an antelope or something. But he made a documentary about Nazis in, and I'm not sure if it was in America, I think it was in America, sort of a new Nazi party. And he went into that situation as a Jew to interview them, and they didn't know he was Jewish, but they became friends with him because he's white. So they just saw him as some documentary maker helping other people understand his cause as a Nazi. So at one point, Louis said, well, would it trouble you if I told you I was a Jew? And he was talking to a bunch of neo-Nazi skinheads. And they said, well, are you? And he said, well, does it matter? And at that moment, the friendship that he'd built with them became more fragile.
Right.
And his conversation then, he said, well, you know, I choose not to tell you whether I am or I'm not. And they said, well, we really need to know. Turn the camera off. And he said, well, why? Why do you want me to turn the camera off? What are you going to do? And they said, don't worry, we're not going to do anything to you. We just need to know whether you're a Jew or not. And what he did was he went into a situation, willingly befriended them, got to know their children, and then sort of turned the tables on them by saying, well, how do you react to me now?
Right. Those preconceived notions didn't exist. Yeah.
So they were challenged because they'd got to know and like him. And that, I think, is the burden that's on all countries today, is to get to know
your enemy.
People.
Well, not your
and
enemy,
not
but get
think
to know
of them immediately as your enemy.
Right.
You know, and
understanding more than you know.
Yeah, and I think that's what comes across. You know, that's clearly a personal philosophy I have that I like to get across in Elephant Men, is that just because they're big and frightening and could crush you with a single flick of a finger doesn't mean that that's what they're going to do, even if they were bred and designed, you know. And one of the things that I think came across in issue one of Elephant Men is that we have that sort of fear of the veteran, the amputee, the guy with a brain damage.
Yeah.
We have that fear of someone who we should have the most compassion for.
Right.
Because they did not end up that way by choice. They were choosing to defend their country, believing it to be the noble thing to do. So it doesn't matter why. It doesn't matter if it's Vietnam. It doesn't matter if it's Iraq. It doesn't matter if it's World War II. World War veterans and war veterans right across the board should invite our compassion. But instead, we tend to react with fear, and we tend to think that they're panhandlers, or, you know, we tend to think they're going to want something from us, or that they're embarrassing to us. And I think that's a huge problem in America right now, and in terms of the administration's attitude towards veterans and cutting the sort of funding that's available for veterans. It's absolutely essential that if we're going to send soldiers to war, we better take care of them and their families afterwards. Otherwise, then no war is worthy. There's no such thing as a just war.
Well, at some point, it's almost like they be going back to what we were talking about earlier, and that dehumanization of something. It's like you blind them out almost. They become numb at some point.
We all do. We're already numb. Every single person in America is numb to war. I mean, you know, the amount of U.S. casualties I saw on CNN this week is past 4,000, but the network news have stopped counting because people aren't interested. You know, there's 2,000 suicides of ex-US soldiers, you know, in the last five years. You know, we don't hear that statistic because it's embarrassing and it makes us uncomfortable. Because really, we won't want a change in why we're fighting a war until we're hungry, or we can't afford to put gas in our cars.
We're fat and happy, and we don't want to worry about it. You know.
Yeah. Well, you and I are fat and happy.
Those are certainly stories that we see in Elephant Man. The lessons that we learn there, and that's one of the things I love about the book is that besides being visually stunning and a great bordering on the fantastic, not bordering on the fantastic, it certainly is a fantastic story. There's depth to it and there's meat to the story.
Right. I think I said last time also, you know, Stan Lee always said that if you surround your characters with a lot of believability, then people will believe the characters no matter how fantastic they are. And I think that is what Ladrone brought to the book. It's definitely what Justin Norman Moritat has brought to the book. And I've been very fortunate in that because of the high quality of their work, I've attracted some talented artists who are sort of attracted to that sort of meat and potatoes approach.
And that guy Chris Burnham.
You know, I think he's on a tailspin now.
It's all downhill.
Well, Richard, it is always a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.
We're going to continue to read as many Elephant Man or Hip Flask stories that you can get out.
And the good news is Ladrone has actually started work again on Hip Flask 4. He finished Incal Finale. Finale Incal, I think it's called. So he is actually at work penciling the next issue of Hip Flask right now.
Awesome. Fantastic. Well, Richard, it's always such a pleasure for us to have you on.
Thank you.
You are just a wealth of information and entertainment, and thanks so much for
being on. All
right.
No problem.
Have a great show.
Good to see you.
All right. You too.
This is the part where Chris and Sal left, so it leaves me the least technical savvy to do the interview. And we're talking to Josh Dysart, who is working on the BPRD 1946, writing it. Paul Azaketa is doing the art. Last issue comes out on Wednesday.
Yes.
I've been loving it. It's great. I love the old. Any flashback stuff with the BPRD's stuff.
Oh, yeah. I was born to write it. I'm having a blast. And, you know, the last issue totally pumps it up to 11. It gets ridiculously pulp awesome.
Well, I don't know how much more pulp it can get when the last issue ended with like a Nazi head in a jar.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
A crab leg.
It is really only the beginning.
You've got Nazis and vampires and tubes of zombie vampire.
Robot gorillas.
No more pulp.
Mechanical,
creatures. Cyborg gorillas.
Demon baby girls.
Yeah, don't leave anything out. Don't leave it. It's the big soup. Honestly, if it had sprung from the mind of anyone other than Mike Mignola, my editor and co-creator on this, it would have been crap.
Yeah.
Only Mike could take that soup and make it awesome.
It's sort of funny for me. I really love the Hellboy stories, but to be honest, I've almost fallen more in love with the BPRD stories. I think for like an old-time comic fan, you know, I love old-time comics. It's that team aspect.
Yeah,
that
absolutely.
But it also mixes the Hellboy sort of mythology stuff into it. So it's a really cool book for, I think, maybe people who don't want to leave sort of the comfort of the superhero team,
yeah,
but they
absolutely
can still get that flavor.
You know, Mike and I, we're slowly going to push the series towards kind of challengers of the unknown territory.
Ooh,
you
nice
know, we're looking forward to being able to have them in their jumpsuits. And like, I mean, it's great. I mean, you know, that's what we're doing. We're building the team. Like, we announced 47 yesterday, and 47 is the story of the first, you know, the first outing of the handpicked team that Broom has sent out. So we're talking about the first real BPRD agents. I mean, you know, 46 was about Broom and his yeah and his peer, you know, but this is a real team where they've looked at the files, they've handpicked them in.
Jumpsuits.
Yeah, oh yeah. Well, they don't get jumpsuits yet. That's
oh, okay. Oh, sorry.
We're taking it slowly.
What issue can we
yeah, what issue
jumpsuits
can we look
we're looking at jumpsuits in the 50s.
Yeah. That was a more
this is more
era
like
that's
Elliot Ness vampire fighter is what we're talking about now.
Okay.
We're talking about fedoras and trench coats. And
is 47 going to be another 5-issue?
Yeah, 5 issues, absolutely. It won't focus on Broom as much as the last one, but we'll get back. Broom is in it, and we'll get back to Broom with 48. So, yeah.
Nice.
And a lot more young Hellboy, too.
Do you have plans to keep sort of going in that age?
Well, yeah, we probably won't do every single year. I mean, yeah.
Let me tell you something. Comic fans are obsessive compulsive.
Yeah,
they
yeah
would love that.
If you skip, like,
yeah,
why don't they do 52?
You got to yeah do them all, or yeah don't skip any, because.
You know, well, you know, to be honest, at the rate we're going, at one retro BPRD story
per
year.
Times were slower back
yeah
then.
Yeah, it's going to be a while. I'll be in my 80s, and we'll be.
There's still, only
yeah
one adventure a year mm-hmm back in the.
Yeah,
the
exactly,
40s and 50s.
Exactly. So, I mean, we really need to start skipping years pretty soon here. Because there's some stuff we want to get to.
You can do a span. Oh, yeah. BPRD 1956 through 62.
It was a
work
nicer. It was a nicer. It was a, you
like
know
a collage.
It's not. It's not really as nice of a title, I'll admit, but it's effective.
Yeah.
You,
yeah.
You can get some, you know, some Don McLean background music. Yeah. It's just a happier time for
yeah,
when,
yeah
for the BPRD.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I'm really looking forward to, you know, the Cold War is my thing, and I think that's a big part of why Mike brought me on. And we started like laying.
He's wearing a communist shirt.
Yeah,
right
yeah, the Cold War is my thing. Gets me hot, actually.
He's got a book by Kissinger.
He's very, yeah, absolutely. And so I think that's a lot of the reason why Mike brought me on 46, because I mean that was really the ground zero for the Cold War. You know, it was Berlin and at the end of the World War II. And so I'm looking forward to getting into the 50s and literally doing our occult James Bond stuff. That's really going to be a blast, and it's going to give a new flavor to the overall Hellboy universe. Once we introduce our occult James Bond,
yeah,
I think it's going to be really tight. And I'll that'll be in about 10 years from now. So so keep reading.
What else? Are you working on anything else besides the BPRD
yeah
stuff right
now? Yeah, I just finished writing. And Cliff Chang has just begun illustrating the art for the graphic novel I did with Neil Young.
Based, oh,
yeah.
Greendale.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I am in the middle of working on, or trying to get enough issues in the can of Unknown Soldier, which will launch
yes
in October. Yeah.
I love, in fact, I got some sketches of Unknown Soldier yesterday.
Oh, awesome.
Says, I love the old
yeah,
Unknown
yeah
Soldier
well,
books.
Well, I
it's
really hope we don't screw it up for you.
And don't worry, I'll just forget about it.
Oh, good. Everywhere I go, people are like, oh, I love the old Unknown Soldier.
And you're
like,
oh, I thought everyone forgot
about
it.
I thought it was unknown.
Yeah.
This is backfiring entirely.
Well, I hope you like it.
I thought no one would remember. And yeah.
It's not like you're working with anything that has any legacy. I mean, it's like you're in the Hellboy universe.
No, no,
no chance
awful
to screw that up.
No, no, no.
You know, that you've got the Unknown
and
Soldier.
I already sunk Swamp Thing, so it's like...
Yeah,
where'd it go from here?
Brian Vaughn did that too, and it worked out for him.
Yeah,
no,
that's the only thing that's kept me afloat. Now there's this industry perception that if you fail at Swamp Thing, you will succeed at everything afterwards.
Swamp Thing's it's a slump buster. Everyone
yeah
jumps on that grenade.
Mark Millar too, you know. Mark yeah Millar took a bullet for Swamp Thing. Absolutely.
If you blow a Swamp Thing run, big things are in store. Don't worry.
No,
about
yeah,
it.
I'd be it's worried. It's the way to go. Really.
I'd be worried if you did Swamp Thing well
and succeeded. Yeah. That would be it.
That's
you'd
it.
You'd be like, yeah, like Roger Moore and James Bond. You would never, ever be really get to do anyone again.
Everyone would kind of look around and be like, this is suspiciously good.
Yeah.
I don't
yeah
quite know
yeah
what
it's
to
surprised
do
Neil Young would have anything to do with you, really.
Yeah, so. No, absolutely. Well, it was only because I failed at Swamp Thing. Like, I want that guy who failed miserably.
Brett
that's
came on the other guy.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, thanks
no
for
pressure
talking to us. I love BPRD 1946.
Awesome.
If you haven't picked it up, it's one of my favorite of the Hellboy Universe books that have come
awesome.
Out.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Good luck.
A blast.
I look forward to 47 coming out.
Thanks,
I look
brother.
Forward to Greendale. Is that, yep.
Yeah, you're doing great.
This is not what I usually do. Usually what happens during the interviews is Chris and Sal do the talking,
yeah.
and I half pay attention and occasionally interject some sort of snarky remarks.
Nice.
So usually I don't have to focus.
Awesome. Well, you've really manned up. You did a great job.
This is my swamp thing, though?
Yeah. Right. This is it. This is your last interview, brother.
Well, it was a pleasure for it to have done it with you.
Absolutely.
So. And thanks, Josh, for staring at me.
I was kind of surprised at your ability to take over. So I was just like, I will just quit.
All right,
this will
then.
Be fine.
All right. Everyone, let's all go our separate ways.
All right. All right, never speak.
Never meet again. Yeah. Break.
And that'll take care of the second part of our Emerald City Comic-Con coverage. Hope you're enjoying it. And if you are, we have one more left. So come back on Monday for an extra-sized episode that'll wrap up the conversations with several different creators and convention-goers and fellow podcasters on the floor at Emerald City Comic-Con. We had a great time, and I hope that you're enjoying the episodes that we've been able to bring to you from there. And if you have, there's a couple different ways to let us know. You can trot on over to the iTunes Music Store and leave us an iTunes Music review. You can email the show at info@aroundcomics.com or any of the primaries individually at sal@aroundcomics.com, tom@aroundcomics.com, or myself at chris@aroundcomics.com. And you can also check out our forum. It's at aroundcomics.com, and it is one of the best online comic book communities out there. It's a way to interact with other like-minded comic book fans. And you can also leave your feedback on episode threads, just like this one. So check any and all of those out. And remember, we'll be back on Monday to wrap up our Emerald City Comic-Con coverage. And then we'll get back on our regular schedule from Chicago and Dark Tower Comics. But in the meantime, in between time, we'll be everywhere in and around comics. Views expressed in the interviews or by guests of the show are solely those of the individuals expressing them and may not reflect the opinions of Around Comics. Any reproduction, rebroadcast, or retransmission without the express written consent of Around Comics is strictly prohibited. All content presented in this program is the sole possession of Around Comics, and this has been an Around Comics production, copyright 2008.